Welcome to Brain Observations, the podcast where we talk about how the brain and mind works and how you can use this knowledge to improve your experience of life. I set out to find and talk to some of the most knowledgeable people out there. And at the end of each episode, I sum up what we've learned from today's guest. Me, I'm Maria Sundell. I'm a clinical neurologist, and with this podcast, I hope to make scientific evidence on well-being and brain health more easily available. And my wish is to inspire you to learn more and find ways to improve your own life. I also want to mention that even though I am a medical doctor, this is a personal project and not affiliated with my hospital. The information in this podcast is meant to educate and inspire and should not be taken as medical advice. I advise you to discuss any potential changes to your lifestyle with your own personal doctor. This is even more important if you're experiencing trouble with your mental health. Today's guest, Michael Inslicht, is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, Canada. His research combines social psychology, cognitive science, and neuroscience. And through studying prejudice, stigmatized groups, and social identity, he found his way to his current primary interest, to understand the underlying nature of self-control. Together with Joel Enbar, he is the co-host of a great podcast called Two Psychologists and Four Beers, where they discuss news and controversies in science, academia, and beyond while, you guessed it, drinking beer. Something I admire about Michael is his ability for critical thinking, willingness to have his beliefs challenged, and courage to question even his own research and correct it if proven wrong. Here we sit down and talk about self-regulation and goal pursuit. We learn about different models to describe the self-regulatory process and discuss what components make for a more successful pursuit of goals. We also talk about ways to develop your own process of creating, working on, and achieving goals in your life. Okay, so fellow podcaster here today, welcome to Brain Observations, Michael.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
How are you doing today?
Doing pretty well. I just moved houses and I realized that my previous house, I'd been living there for 11 years, which is the longest I'd lived anywhere, even my childhood homes. So we had lots of stuff. It was a challenging move. But I'm happy we're on this side of the move where I'm just here full of boxes as opposed to actually having to physically move things anymore and get stressed out about packing. So I'm much better this week than last week.
I always find it kind of fascinating when you move because when I think about moving, I'm always thinking like, yeah, maybe a couple of boxes for the kitchen, maybe a couple of boxes for the bedroom. I can do it in 3 hours. I don't have so much stuff. And then you start going through and it never ends. And it takes so much more time than you anticipate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is very close to home. We hired someone to help us pack. And this person who's a professional packer estimated incorrectly and estimated that it would take her 12 hours. But in fact, it probably should have taken her 24 hours. And after the first day, we realized she's never going to finish. So we, my wife and I, just went into high gear and started working like mad. But yeah, it's. I think, you know, moving is one of those really, really stressful events. I do not recommend it for anyone.
But it connects very well to today's topic of self-regulation, because I assume that you would have to use quite a lot of self-regulation throughout the process.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I suppose, yeah. I mean, self-regulation, very broadly defined, I think in many aspects, whether it be planning, whether it be controlling your anger impulses and frustration impulses. Yeah, I think it certainly plays a part in moving and in many other things.
And so today we're going to talk about the psychology and the neuroscience of self-regulation and goal pursuit. And this is an area that you've been involved in for quite some time now, right?
Yeah, I've been studying self-regulation, self-control, goal pursuit. Oh boy, I'm not exactly sure. Since the mid-2000s, maybe like, you know, late aughts. So I think my first published paper on the topic was maybe 2006, 2008, something like that.
And when I was going through one of your articles on different models of self-regulation, I came to the part where you talked about the choice between a delicious poutine and a healthy salad, and my mind immediately went, this guy is Canadian.
That's right. One of my co-authors, Brent Roberts, he took exception to my examples because he didn't like the word poutine and delicious together, but clearly that revealed him as someone who's never actually tried poutine. So
I just thought it was amazing, especially since I think a lot of people globally will not even know what a poutine is.
Yeah, very few. So it's an extra little thing you have to Google when you read my article. Yeah.
So in order to clarify a little bit the different terms, because there are a lot of different terms when it comes to goal pursuit, self-regulation, and especially since it coincides both with psychology, with neuroscience, with cognitive neuroscience specifically, how would you define self-regulation and how does that differ from self-control, or is it the same thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it's one that I think trips many people up, and I think there are many, many definitions out there. So this was the hardest part of our paper, was actually trying to define the terms, and actually, I believe I'm not fully satisfied with our definition of self-control in that paper. In fact, I probably would want to modify it slightly, but you know, I can tell you how I feel about self-regulation. So I think self-regulation is a really, really broad term used to refer to any process that helps people bring their goals about. And you can think of it as, you know, maybe having three major components. You know, one is the setting of a goal. One is the monitoring of goal progress, how you're doing, and seeing if you're making sufficient progress, if you're acting in accordance with your goals. And then you have a third aspect, which is like the motor of self-regulation, which is actually acting towards your goal. But all three aspects are involved, and self-regulation can refer to, you know, like I said, goal setting, planning, noticing when your goals are offline, acting in accordance with goals, restraining yourself. So self-regulation, you know, subsumes the term self-control. So self-control is one form of self-regulation, but there are many, many other forms of self-regulation. So like I said, goal setting is not really about self-control, it's about self-regulation. So then what do I mean by self-control? So self-control is the process via which we bias our behavior when we're faced with cognitive conflict because we might have two or more goals that, you know, press on us to act in a certain way. And then we need to somehow make a choice about how to act in that way. And self-control would be regulating conflict and then making a choice and acting in one way or another. Now, you know, where I started my answer to your question by saying I wasn't fully satisfied with the definition we had in our chapter. And one thing I would change was that in the chapter, we suggested conflict was necessary for self-control. And in fact, it could be even the anticipation of conflict is, you know, really part of self-control. I'm not so sure about the anticipated part anymore. I'm now thinking that if you're anticipating some conflict in the future, maybe that should be part of self-regulation. That's an anticipatory, a proactive step. It's involved in planning as well. But I think when you're actually faced with conflict in the moment, that's when I might say self-control is really, really needed.
So would it be fair then to say the self-regulation as a term is your brain's way of visualize and plan for a goal, then monitor the activity to reach it, as well as drive the activity towards it?
Yeah, I'm that's a good answer. I don't know if I'd specify brain in there. I mean, brain is involved, clearly, but brain and mind are, they're clearly related. I'm not a dualist, but I'm a psychologist, and we think about, you know, the constructs of mind. These are constructs. In many of our studies, we're not measuring brain directly, although sometimes we do, but I'm more comfortable talking about the mind.
And when you talk about cognitive control, then, is that the sort of monitoring part of self-regulation?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. The relationship between cognitive control and self-regulation and self-control. You know, if you actually look at the definitions like provided by various theorists, so like one of my all-time heroes is Jonathan Cohen from Princeton University. If you actually look at the definitions of cognitive control, they're practically indistinguishable from the definitions of self-regulation. So it's, you know, essentially it's, you know, it's the processes that allow for flexible goal pursuit when you might have more habitual response tendencies, you know, present. So that sounds like a combination of self-regulation and self-control a little bit. The real difference is more the history in which these terms have been discussed. So the term cognitive control has been discussed by cognitive psychologists, by neuropsychologists, and it's typically associated with low-level tests. So perhaps one of the more famous tests that psychologists have produced is a test called the Stroop Task, where people are you know, presented with color words that are presented themselves in different kinds of colors, and it involves cognitive interference. And how you perform on that task is seen to be a reflection of your level of cognitive control. But, you know, again, these are not natural constructs. These are constructs that we've made up, and they come from various traditions that we have about them. So I don't think there's not a clear line between cognitive control, self-regulation, and self-control.
And I think the word that most people use when they think about these things is willpower.
Yes. Well, it's certainly, the public, they'll use the word willpower. I mean, so Roy Baumeister, who's a very well-known social psychologist, and I think one could argue, at least among social psychologists, really energized the field and getting people interested in this field. He talks about willpower. He's a very, very well-known book, bestseller, which I assign to my students, called, I think it's called Willpower, Rediscovering Human's Greatest Strength, or something like this. But it's really kind of a colloquial term to refer to self-control, kind of just the power of restraining oneself, the ability to inhibit desires, thoughts, emotions, etc. But again, another construct that kind of fits in this soup of constructs, and how they relate to one another is not always clear.
And how do you generally perform research on these things? Like, what is the setup of a research situation?
Oh, there's so many different ways of studying it. So, well, one I've already mentioned, you can use something like the Stroop task, which is a simple little, almost like a stupid task, but it's not stupid at all, because it reveals something, I think, profound about humans, and that, our attentions are limited, and when there's interference, we have a tougher time regulating our attentions. And that might have something to do with how we control our minds, our emotions, our actions. So that's just one simple way of assessing something that relates to willpower or control. But there are studies, classic studies, for example, looking at, how does willpower change over the course of an hour or of a day? So you might give people various temptations and then see how they regulate over time. Does the regulatory ability, is it stable over time? Does it decrease over time? Typically it decreases, although that's quite a controversial topic, because it might not decrease nearly as much as we think, if at all. And if it does decrease, it might take hours, not minutes. So that'd be one way. Another way would be, giving people a goal, or having people nominate a goal that they have. So for example, in one of our studies we had, it was conducted in Montreal, Quebec, where students would tell us, nominate some of their goals. So they might learn, one of their goals might be to learn French or to learn how to bake. And then we can track them over months, if not years, and then examine what ingredients, what constructs, what psychological ingredients did they use to help them bring control about. So that's, another example of a way to study self-control or willpower in the lab.
Because there is some research pointing to the benefit of self-control.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's lots of research. I mean, I don't think anyone goes around thinking that willpower is bad. There's been pushback, including by myself, that it might not be as good as you think. Perhaps the most famous studies, a series of studies conducted by the late and great Walter Mischel, who looked at the extent to which young children, I believe around 4 to 5, the extent to which they could delay their gratification of eating something sweet, in this case was the
marshmallow test.
Exactly, the marshmallows. What Mischel did was he had these young children, seated in front of one marshmallow and told them, listen, hey, if you like marshmallows, which all of them did, you want 2 marshmallows. And if you want to, just wait, hold on here, wait a few minutes, and I'll come back. And if you can wait till I come back, I'll give you 2. And then secretly, Mischel and his devious research assistants were timing how long the students could wait before they, ate the marshmallow or rang a bell to call the experimenter. And lo and behold, the length of time that children could wait predicted self-regulatory ability, or predicted all kinds of outcomes later in life. It predicted whether they went to college or not, predicted their grades, it predicted their relationship satisfaction, predicted the extent to which they used and abused drugs. Neurologists, it predicted certain patterns of brain activity related to cognitive control. So it seems to, this ability to delay, at least in this marshmallow test, seems to be related to all kinds of good things. And that's a very, sexy study. But it actually turns out not to be the best study. There's a much, much better study out there conducted in New Zealand by Moffat and colleagues, where they tracked thousands of young New Zealand children and measuring what they called self-control in children, either via their performance or as rated by teachers and parents, and then followed them for decades later. And they found that those children, the greater their degree of self-control, again, as measured by them and behavior and parents and teachers, predicted whether they, were convicted of a criminal offense 30 years later. It predicted their mental health, their physical health. It predicted whether they used drugs, abused drugs. It predicted how much money they had in the bank. It predicted whether they were in debt or not. So it predicted all kinds of amazing outcomes. And this study was fabulous because it critically controlled for intelligence. And we know that the outcomes that intelligence predicts are very similar to the outcomes that self-regulation predicts. So this study controlled for intelligence and still found a benefit for self-control. So clearly, you know, whatever was being measured by Moffat and his colleagues, they called that self-control. And we can argue maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but that is an incredibly important thing. So we want more of that.
Do we know anything about how much of it we are born with and how much that is developed from cultural context? How much is developed from family context? How much can you develop yourself?
I think your question is a really good one, which is about to what extent is this, you know, genetic, heritable versus learned versus cultural? As with all things, the answer is yes. So clearly there's some genetic components. So for example, one personality trait that is strongly related to willpower is a personality trait called conscientiousness. So personality psychologists have discovered over the past few decades that humans, one could argue it's Westerners especially, so people from North America and Europe, but I think there's some cross-cultural studies as well suggesting that it's universal, that there are five basic major personality dimensions. Maybe there's some people argue there might be a sixth, but one of those is something called conscientiousness, and that correlates very, very highly with trait measures of self-control or grit. And this we know is heritable. 50% or more, plus or minus, is heritable, which leaves a lot for environmental influences and cultural influences. And 100% culture makes a difference too. You see this very, very famously, for example, you know, Max Weber talked about something called the Protestant work ethic, whereas, you know, religious traditions led people in Europe, especially in Western and Northern Europe, to value the industry, to value hard work, to value labor, and to derive pleasure from these things. So cultures that are exposed to these sorts of ideas will value work, will see it as meaningful, will see it as important. But it's not just Westerners. There's also clearly, other cultural traditions. So Confucian traditions, there seems to be some sort of value of you know, the process of working. Yeah, so it's not, you know, there's lots of cultures where, you know, that value it more and less. So yeah, culture also makes a difference.
And as you mentioned before, there are several different ways or different perspectives you can have on self-regulation. Could you go through a little bit how self-regulation can be described by some of these models?
Yeah, so really we can just look at the different levels of analysis. So this is a really, really massive area in psychology, but it's reached into, you know, economics, sociology, anthropology, evolutionary biology. I mean, a lot of people are studying this, even zoology. A lot of people are interested in the extent to which organisms, humans and otherwise, can regulate their behaviors. But because it's such a broad topic, there have been so many models proposed at different levels of analysis. So in this one paper that we've been discussing, we tried to bring in various models, constraining it to psychology mostly. I think there might be a couple that are influenced by economics there, some cognitive neuroscience as well. And the issue is that many of the models, you know, kind of make, they barely even talk to one another. So it's hard to know how they fit together. But I'll just give you kind of a rough, you know, maybe a naming of a few models that I think are a bit more important. So one model that's super general, very, very old, it's called the cybernetic model of control. We've already kind of discussed it a little bit when we define self-regulation. This is a model based on the study of like physiological systems. I know a lot of people think of it as, you know, computing systems, but that term was later co-opted by, you know, a computer scientist, but actually was first described in the human body with, you know, homeostatic kinds of mechanisms. And essentially a cybernetic model is a feedback model, a model where you have a set point or a goal. And you have a way of sensing the environment to see if it matches the goal or the set point. And then if it doesn't match, you have some mechanism to regulate or to correct the mismatch. A thermostat works on this very, very concept. Simple robots work on this very, very concept. And simple physiological systems work on this concept as well. So it's a really broad model, general model, and it helps us understand self-regulation in our mind. Modern cognitive neuroscience models, for example, there's a model called conflict monitoring, which suggests that the anterior cingulate cortex, specifically the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, a part of the brain, of course, plays a role in monitoring for conflicts between various motor modalities or even other sorts of modalities. And when there's conflict present, it kind of rings an alarm bell in some way and then feeds forward to other parts of the brain that might regulate things. So that's kind of one very, very general model, but highly influential. There are other models. So for example, probably the really a very, very famous one, and it's as old as Aristotle, is dual process models. This is, you know, models that have become very, very kind of in vogue in the past 10 years or 20 years, especially with the publication of Daniel Kahneman's very influential book called Thinking Fast and Slow. Daniel Kahneman is a very well-known psychologist, also won the Nobel Prize in economics. That's how influential he is. He won a Nobel Prize in a different field. And in his book and in much of his work, he describes, really, you can think of it, two kinds of brain matter, or mind matter. There is a what might be called, you know, unoriginally system one and system two. System one is emotional, it's fast, it's associative, it's inflexible, it's reactive. It's very, very useful because it's fast and it allows us to respond, you know, quickly to kind of stimuli that we're familiar with. And then you have a second system, which is deliberate and slow and thoughtful and logical and rational. And so dual process models of self-control suggest that self-control, you know, is brought about when these two kind of forms of thought conflict with one another. When the hot system, the system one, you know, sees poutine, right? And for me, at least, you know, sees that and immediately wants to eat it. Even if I'm not hungry, it doesn't matter. And then I have, you know, I see the poutine, I immediately want to grab and reach for it. But then right before I reach for it, the second form part of my mind is like, whoa, slow down. Poutine is a calorie bomb. It's never good for you. And in fact, the half-life of enjoyment of poutine is about 1 second, because as soon as you take the bite, you regret it. But it takes time to think about it, to like remember, oh yes, I've got a goal of being fit, of being healthy, and then maybe I can stop myself. So these two things do battle. So Aristotle talked about, you know, a charioteer being driven by two horses, and, you know, self-control can be thought of as this charioteer kind of reining in emotion and regulating, you know, with logic and reason. So this is a very influential, you know, kind of way of construing self-control or self-regulation. There's another model that's much more recent, but gaining steam, gaining traction. It's a series of models that come from economics. These are value-based models. And essentially what these models suggest is self-control is nothing special. Self-control is just an ordinary decision that you make, just like any other kind of decision. Maybe what makes it slightly special is that it might be more emotional. So it's not, you know, famously, if you go in North America into a grocery store and you go to the cereal aisle, you've got like thousands of choices. What do I choose? Is that kind of choice self-control? Well, it's not really that different. You have like different attributes, attributes that you make your decision based on: health, taste, you know, variety, all the different kinds of things. Then you got to make a decision about, do I want this cereal or that cereal? And maybe self-control is really similar. Do I want poutine or do I want to eat salad? Which one? Now, it's slightly different there because it's a heated choice. Like I really want it because I've got these associations with poutine, with pleasure and enjoyment. And so it's maybe a little bit different than a regular choice, but not, you know, it's a difference in degree, not a difference in kind. So self-control, according to these economic models, is simply adding up the pros and cons of each of the choices you have in front of you and then making a choice based on the pros and cons. Now, there is a rationality that enters there. So, you know, from the get-go, it sounds a classic economic model, you know, thinking that humans are rational agents. Of course, I'm going to, you know, compute, you know, your choice A and B and like a robot decide between these two things. But there are some irrationalities that enter even those choices. So, for example, something that offers you a reward right now is seen as more positive, is valued as more positively compared to something that gives you a reward later on. So this is called temporal discounting. Discounting the value of a reward if it's delayed with time. There's also rewards are discounted if effort is involved in reaping the reward. So yes, I can get a reward, but I have to work really, really hard to get this reward. Well, maybe I'm not going to like it as much. So there's all these different kind of irrationalities that enter the choice, but nonetheless, it's still a choice. And maybe one last model I'll discuss before pausing. Because there are lots out there. And this model is very, very famous and maybe now infamous. And this is a model that got me interested in self-control. And this is a model, it's called the resource model of self-control. It's related to the concept of ego depletion. So this is a model proposed by Roy Baumeister and his colleagues. And it makes a really, really simple point, but yet it captured the imagination of an entire generation of scholars. And the point it makes is that self-control is thought to be a limited resource. It's thought to run out with use. So maybe there's some sort of pool of something swishing in your brain. You know, it's not even a metaphor, according to some scholars. It's actually glucose, brain glycogen, that's thought to power the will. And of course, there's some truth there. Of course, glucose and glycogen are really, really important for the brain, really, really important for the body. But the idea here is that once you regulate yourself, you use up that resource, glucose or whatever else it might be. And then you eventually run out of it and you have less of it and you can no longer regulate yourself. So if I have, let's say I've got a terrible boss, which I don't, I've got a lovely boss, but let's say I did, and I was working with this person, you know, for that day, and I just wanted to scream at this person because they're just telling, you know, making me do things that I just dislike. But I know, of course, you scream at your boss, you get fired. So you got to regulate your emotions. You got to, you know, stay cool. But I'm doing that the entire day. Well, guess what? According to this model, that takes energy. That eats up the resource of self-control. And then towards the end of the day, I might have less of it, or I might even run out of it completely. And then when I'm, you know, walk by the poutine shop, it'll be almost impossible for me to say no to it because my self-control resources have run out and someone offers me the poutine. I'm like, absolutely, yes, I need the poutine. So this kind of idea is thought to explain why we have a tougher time with willpower towards the end of the day. As we've, you know, regulated ourselves over the course of a day, we might have less of this resource and then have tougher time later. Now, I said this model is controversial and infamous, and that's because this model is seen as the poster child for what psychologists and other social scientists are calling the replication crisis. It turns out, despite there being, by some counts, 600 or so papers or studies, individual studies, appearing to support the notion of ego depletion, of this, you know, self-control running out, it turns out these findings are not replicable. When you use the, you know, the best transparent methods out there, we cannot consistently get this effect of ego depletion. So now people are trying to rethink that maybe self-control is not based on a resource. Maybe it doesn't run out so readily. Now, of course, there's still some truth to, you know, this ego depletion idea, but it's much less exciting and it's much maybe less interesting and a bit more boring. And that's simply the idea that we get tired. And when we get tired, our cognitions are affected. We think a bit more slowly. We're a little bit more slowly to react. We're less motivated to do things. And when that happens, yes, many things are affected, including our ability to regulate ourselves or our desire to regulate ourselves.
Yeah, because to me, I would automatically, without having all of this background knowledge of the research that you've been going through, just think that you've been exerting yourself, you've been using a lot of effort during the day, you might have had a lot of negative effect connected with this, and you get more and more tired. So then, by the end of the day, not only do you have less mental energy to expend, but you also might have a higher need for some form of gratification, something that makes you, gives you a little energy boost or makes you feel a little bit better about yourself, or just some form of quick fix to your psychological state.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we try to justify indulgences for ourselves. If we've worked hard, because, like, so for example, I just started this podcast saying I've been moving. So I'm working physically and mentally hard every day. And at the end of the day, I'm like, screw it. I'm going to have, an extra beer today, or I'm going to have cookies today or whatever. I feel like I owe it to myself. So it's not that I can't say no to a beer, or I can't say no to cookies. It's that I don't want to say no. My desire right now is for these things. I feel I deserve it. I've earned it. I want a reward for myself. Is that self-control failure? I mean, it might be. I mean, my desires have changed. But, or is it that I'm allowing it for myself? Am I trying to self-control myself and I can't? Or is it that I no longer want to control myself right now?
I think it speaks more to that you're starting to put a different view on this thing, that normally you would see the cookie as something negative. I'm not allowed to do this. This is something that is not good for me. This is something that is a character flaw or whatever, to want to have this cookie and eating it. But then you connect it to having done something good, and all of a sudden you give yourself the permission to like it. And then you feel this sort of positive kick out of eating it in a way that you wouldn't otherwise, because you would shame yourself. I think it has a lot to do with the emotion behind it and the way we view things.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think really it's, you know, so a number of years ago, I proposed a model whereby we thought that what happened when you got tired was that, you know, it wasn't that abilities changed, it's that your priorities changed. So just kind of think about the course of your own day. At the beginning of the day, you might, you know, start out really ambitious and like, I got to do this, I got to do that, I got all these things to do. By the end of the day, you're like, no, I'm thinking about resting, I'm thinking about relaxing. And desire shifts, I think they operate on circadian rhythms as well. But they also have to do with like what actually you did over the course of those days, of the course of those hours, I should say. But, you know, we shouldn't overstate it though as well. Like there is some effect of fatigue, and there's some effect over time of day effects, but they're actually much smaller than we think. They're not as robust as we might imagine. Like there's lots of interesting studies on fatigue where people will be kind of sleep deprived for a day or two. And yes, their cognitions are affected, but not as dramatically as you might imagine.
It has a lot to do with the motivation behind the behavior. Because even if you are completely depleted, if you get the right motivation, you can kick into high gear.
Absolutely. You know, someone puts a gun, literally puts a gun next to your head, you can do what's needed. Your energy is not, you know, has not been depleted. It's there. It's just like you haven't, now you have got a reason to mobilize it.
And so I assume that there's been some research as well, looking at people that do have good conscientiousness, they have self-regulation, and they achieve these goals, as you said, with the New Zealand study. What are these people doing differently than people of so-called low self-control?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And the best answer is we don't really know. We have some clues, but we don't have like definitive answers. I think for a long time, we assumed that the people who are at high self-control or high in conscientiousness, the reason they're getting all the good stuff in life, you know, more money in the bank, better relationships, all that good stuff, is because they engage in more self-control. Like they engage in more self-control in the moment. But it turns out to be that's not the case at all. In fact, it's the opposite. People with high trait self-control or high conscientiousness or high grit, these are all synonyms, they do not engage in more self-control in the moment. In fact, they engage in it less. They restrain their impulses less than people who have low self-control. Now that seems paradoxical. And that's because we're using the same word to describe different things. So what are they doing? Again, we don't really know, but it looks like they might be doing self-regulatory things that aren't necessarily self-control things. So maybe they're planning more. They're better at planning, right? So they plan out their day, they map out their day, and then they also feel guilty when they don't meet their plans. And because we know that conscientious people are more guilt-prone, but because they're more guilt-prone and they're aware that they're more guilt-prone, they will engage in behaviors to avoid feeling guilty. So they plan and then they meet their plans because they find the guilt of not meeting their plans so aversive. So there's a lot more planning. There's a lot more goal setting, we think. But you know, other than that, we don't really know. What we do know is they're not necessarily, you know, restraining themselves more. They're not necessarily like stopping themselves more. They seem to be less tempted by things.
Okay.
Which is strange. How do you get people less tempted? You have to kind of re-engineer their desires in some way. But it does seem to be the case that people who are conscientious don't desire the things that will lead them astray.
And then there is this dilution of means to pursue a goal. That if you have a goal that is kind of unspecific, such as I'm going to get healthy, there are so many different ways that you can do that, that it becomes kind of difficult to choose between them, and you have a higher risk of ending up doing nothing at all, rather than having a specific goal such as I'm going to start a spinning class and I'm going to pay for it and it's every Thursday at 6, then you have a higher chance of actually going through with it and achieving the goal of becoming healthier.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, in terms of goal setting, we know that a concrete goal, a specific goal with a specific time horizon is much more effective than something that's abstract and vague. So we know that goal setting is good. Like, absolutely. It's better to say have a goal of I want to be fit than have no goal at all. But you can do a lot better. You can set a way better goal than I want to be fit than just saying I want to be fit. You can say, like you said, I want to go, you know, start a spinning class 3 days a week on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 6 p.m. after I get home from work. Something like this. So, and maybe the conscientious people are, again, naturally able to plan out and to specify and to concretize their goals. But again, this is speculation. We don't really know. But I think your broader point of there being more specific ways of setting goals and also setting challenging goals too is really critical. Those are clearly more effective. And if we can get people to do that, we know that that helps them meet their goals more readily.
And what do you mean putting more challenging goals?
So when people set goals, you can set a goal that's like very, very easy. So so I'm, you know, a professor, I do a lot of writing. I could say, okay, I'm going to write a paragraph today, the entire day, I'm going to write a paragraph. Well, you're probably going to meet that goal because if you're a professor, you probably can do some writing already. But if you set a more challenging goal, like, okay, I want to write 2 pages a day, and I'm going to give myself 2 hours to do it. So now it's like 2 hours, 2 pages. You might not fully meet it every single time, but by challenging yourself and pushing yourself, you're more likely to kind of make some progress on your goals. So, but it, you know, you want to find a sweet spot. It can't be too challenging because then you get overwhelmed, you get discouraged. You have to find something that's like kind of pushes you to your limit, but not too much.
But do you think there are different people here, that there are people that enjoy the effort process and that is why this functions better for them, and that there are people that take pride in the work that they do, possibly also in relation to other people, that they build their self-esteem on other people's view of them and therefore like to do the effort as a form of validation?
Yeah, these are all excellent questions. Yes, there are clearly people, so conscientious people, they also enjoy effort. One facet of conscientiousness is something called industriousness, which is like enjoying working, enjoying the effort. Maybe enjoying is a bit too strong. It could be tolerating it or finding it less aversive. And as we discussed earlier, there are cultural values that kind of bleed into it. So for example, if you look up the word effort on Google, you're going to see hundreds, if not thousands, of maxims, of aphorisms, sayings about, like, you know, no effort, no glory. So we have all these cultural products that tell us, you know, victory is incomplete if you don't work.
On the other side of pain is glory.
Right. So yes, there are certainly people like that, and maybe that's also another facet of why conscientious people can get their goals done. It's not that they're necessarily engaging in control. They're working hard and they enjoy the hard work and they find it meaningful. And, you know, the real question is, can that be taught and trained? I think yes. We already talked about cultural differences, but let's say beyond cultural differences, you know, let's say we're all in Sweden, we're all in Canada. Can I get, you know, students or people who feel they would like to have more control, can I teach them to value effort? Can I teach them to value making choices that are difficult? We think so, although we're testing that now, but it's still to be seen whether, if we can do it and how tractable it is and how scalable it is as well.
Yeah. And if you consider how different we are as people, we have different minds, we have different contexts, we have different situations. I think self-awareness is one critical point, to know, what does my situation look like? How does my mind or brain function? When am I at my best? When am I at my worst? And then try to adapt a little bit to that as well. And also try to look at goals as something, why am I driven to do this thing? Am I exercising because I need to look good because I want people to tell me that I'm hot? Or am I exercising because of the actual health aspects of it, because I want to have more mobility, I want to have less pain, I want to be stronger so that I am less inhibited when I don't know, run around with my kids? To look at the actual motivation behind the goals might be a powerful way to sort of create goals that you can achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably one of the best pieces of advice you can get about, you know, self-regulation, is examining what is driving you in that specific goal. So why is that goal important to you? Why are you pursuing that goal? And we know that there are better ways of relating to your goals and worse ways of relating to your goals. And by better, I mean, if a goal is intrinsic to you, if it's truly what you want, it's truly what you value, well, you're going to have a much easier time accomplishing that goal, even when you're tired, even when you're, you know, in a bad mood, even when you're drunk. These things, you know, if you truly love these things, they'll come about. Whereas if you can also value something because you think you ought to like it. Yeah, I really don't like salad. I don't really like broccoli, but I know I'm supposed to eat this stuff and I'm going to eat it. But guess what? When you're stressed out, when you have had a tough day of moving, you know, you're not going to go grab salad. You're going to grab the poutine instead. So really, like, trying to, when you set a goal, trying to really identify with it and see truly, like, what do I love about this? And if you can't find something to love about it, then maybe you want to reconsider why you're doing this, or try to find other reasons why you might, you know, really value this thing.
And might it be a good thing as well to create accountability and try to involve other people in the goal? Let's say that I would want to be fit and healthy for the sake of my children as well, so that they have a healthy parent that can play with them and that can, I don't know, throw them up and down in the air, which they like, or try to add some form of volunteering or some form of thinking of others into the goal as a way of externalizing it from the self, giving a bit more accountability and maybe another drive to actually complete it.
Yeah, so this is like, these are other inputs that will help, you know, keep you committed to your goal, is having other people. So for example, having exercise buddies, and if you miss a day, they'll text you, hey, where are you? We're waiting for you. Or making an announcement about a public announcement about a goal that can, you know, keep you accountable as well. There's another thing called like a pre-commitment. So doing something locking yourself into a choice before the choice becomes a hot choice. And by hot choice, I mean where you're actually facing a real temptation. So for example, I'll give you an example that I use every day. And that is that I have a problem regulating my internet usage. I have a problem, especially with social media, although I think I've now tamed it. But for a long, long time, I couldn't. And I would have these little blocks on my phone and on my computer that on a schedule would turn me off, you know, certain websites like Twitter or Facebook or whatever. So I committed to the schedule. And then when the schedule came up, like, bang, I'm off. And then I'm like, even though I really, really want to check Twitter now, I know someone is, you know, I got to say something right now. Well, I can't get on. So I've pre-committed. So it's another way of regulating yourself that doesn't involve, in this case, self-control, right? So I'm anticipating a conflict, but I'm taking a step to avoid it.
You put the phone in the trunk of the car so you can't text and drive.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There's actually these devices, a cookie jar that actually has a lock.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, that you can set a timer to it. And I think I heard of a woman who did, she put all the phones of the family in that jar and turned the lock. And then nobody could access their phones. And then they had to have dinner together and nobody could be checking their phones or their media, including the parents and I think probably teenage kids. And that was a way of ensuring that they would have family time together. I think it's kind of smart.
I think it's a great idea, yeah. I've heard of something called the phone stack. It's the same thing. Every time you go to a table, just stack your phones in one little corner and leave it there. Yeah, these are good ideas.
Do we know when and why willpower became so moral? At least in our Western society, there is a lot of morality to it. Like, it's a virtue to have a lot of willpower and to resist urges and to resist desires and to do things that are considered boring or considered effortful, but that will give you the glory of, I don't know, being the person that eats a salad all the time.
Yeah, really, really good question. It's not one that I have really studied heavily. Actually, I just saw a paper. I was asked to review a paper recently, I think trying to address this issue. And just from skimming that abstract, so I'm going to be riffing from what I read, it seems like one reason it might become moral is that if you have a group of people engaging in self-controlled behavior, it can solve a lot of like cooperation problems that we have. So in our society, one of the biggest challenges is how does a group of primates work together to build things, to work, you know, to have society and culture. Our cultural is a construct. I mean, our society is a construct. It can collapse, but it needs, you know, people to cooperate and to obey certain rules and norms. And if we can moralize the transgressions of those norms, then we can get people, we can mobilize people to work together and to have a more cohesive society. So that'd be one reason why, is that it can allows people to work together.
And then that has sort of just snuck into things such as physical fitness and these things. People who are not physically fit are deemed lazy. And there are all of these sort of constructs around this that puts a moral value on something that isn't inherently moral.
Yes. I mean, like I said earlier, I mean, I think you need these kind of pressures there just, you know, to keep society going to some extent. And I think, you know, the reason it might apply to something like eating is what you described. It could be a byproduct. It could be like, oh, we needed this thing. And then it kind of just tapers down to even kind of personal choices. That could be one thing. But it could also be something with eating. In many societies, not the neighbor to my south, but most democracies, modern democracies, healthcare is a collective problem. It's a collective issue. And we know that if we can get our populations eating better and exercising regularly, that we'll have fewer expenses in our healthcare system. So again, it's a collective problem. So even these things that we think are just these personal choices might actually, the reason they're moralized is because it helps the collective survive and maximize, you know, our resources. But I think the byproduct explanation also works there.
So if you could give one advice on well-being to the audience, what would that be?
I'm not sure I have any advice. How about this one? Enjoy your life. I think we've talked a lot about work and labor in this, you know, in this podcast. But you know, all work and no play makes Johnny a dull boy. It also makes Johnny an unhealthy boy. So I think we also need balance. I think we need pleasure. We need leisure. And that's also why I think self-control wanes, willpower wanes, is because, you know, we're it's too much on the effort and labor side and we want a little bit of leisure. But I do think leisure is good for our mental health, our physical health. It's also good for our productivity. So, and again, kind of speaking to someone from Sweden, where I think there's lots of value to holidays and vacations, something in North America we don't value nearly as much. I think you're doing it right. I think there needs to be this balance there. So, yeah.
I think the enjoyment of life, what people often miss out on, because being a doctor, I see firsthand that you don't know exactly how much life you have left. Nobody knows. But if you enjoy life, then you have good quality of the life, no matter the length. And I think that is really, really important. And people kind of miss out on that when they think, I'm miserable now. But when this thing happens, or when I reach this goal, then I'm going to be happy. And we put this thing in the future instead of looking at, okay, well, what can I do today to be happy and just truly content with where I am?
Right. So, I mean, even there, the way you were speaking, you're talking essentially about delaying gratification, how like if we delay gratification forever, it's not good for our mental health. I mean, so this is where we need balance. Like, yeah, you need to delay gratification. Like you shouldn't eat the poutine every single time, but once in a while, it's okay. You know, same thing with alcohol. I just, in my podcast, Who's Psychologist for Beers, I'm going to plug my podcast. We just had Edward Slingerland on, who wrote a book, he is an Asian studies expert and a sinologist. And he wrote a book called Drunk, looking at the cultural evolutionary benefits of drinking and alcohol for our societies. A drink every once in a while is okay too. And I'm speaking to a doctor now, so maybe you're going to, you know, maybe add some qualifications and caveats, but not just in terms of the kind of enjoyment it gives you, but there are some other benefits too. So I think having enjoyment in life is also really, really important. It's not all about work. But it seems like we've veered a little bit from our topic of self-regulation.
I think we've gone in all kinds of different directions. But I think that's what's interesting about talking about the mind. You can try to put it down into some form of construct that it's, you have the goal, you have the monitoring, you have the action, but there are so many different factors that intervene. There are so many different psychological factors. There are so many contextual factors that will decide what goals you come up with, how you act in a certain situation, how you stay with a goal, or how you may leave a goal. And so there is no way of clearly defining it.
Yeah, I agree. This is why, you know, I've been studying it for so long, and this is why many people will be studying it in the future, because it's critical, yet multifaceted. So it's a really big problem.
So thank you so much for coming on to this podcast. And I think everybody should go and check out Two Psychologists and Four Beers, because it's really amazing as well. And again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So let's break this down into some key points from today's talk. Self-regulation can broadly be defined as any process that helps people bring their goals about. It can be divided into three major aspects, the first being the setting of the goal, meaning deciding and planning. Then there is monitoring the progress, which is looking at where you are at any given time point in reference to the end point of the goal. And then the third part is acting on it to move things forward. Self-control, on the other hand, is part of self-regulation, and it comes into action when there is cognitive conflict between, for example, two goals, or one goal and an immediate conflicting desire. So self-control would be regulating conflict as it appears in the moment by making a choice and acting in one way or another. Willpower is a more colloquial term for self-regulation that we most often use when talking about restraint from immediate desires, as opposed to acting on goals with more long-term benefit. So it was believed for a long time that people with high self-regulation was using more willpower than other people, but that turned out not to be true. They actually use less. They restrain their impulses less than people low in self-control. This might be because they're better at planning and avoiding tempting situations in the first place. So what can you do yourself to develop your skills around goal pursuit? Well, let's look at it from those three aspects: setting the goal, monitoring it, and driving the action. So goal setting is a vitally important part, and it's improved by several different things. One is making it very specific. If there are too many different means to achieving a goal, such as I will get healthy, for example, it's too vague and we tend to not choose any approach or choose something that is very easy but doesn't bring about much change. By specifying instead, such as saying, I will take a spin class at 6 p.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday after work, we're more likely to engage in the behavior and drive us toward the goal of improved health. Another way to specify a goal is to set a time horizon and possibly also divide it into distinct steps. Visualizing the endpoint of a goal is a very powerful way of giving your mind clear instructions on what it's supposed to work towards. Setting challenging goals is also beneficial because even if you don't meet your exact expectations, you're likely to have achieved more than if the task at hand was very easy, since we tend to stop at our pre-specified set point. It's important, though, to remember that if it's not reasonable, we tend to get overwhelmed and might just get stuck doing nothing instead. Pre-commitment is another tool, which means locking yourself into a choice before conflict or temptation occurs. An example of this are time locks on social media apps limiting your use of them, or placing your phone in the trunk while driving so you can't be distracted by it. When it comes to monitoring goals, writing down the details around the goal, including your motivation for it, the timeline, and the plan of action, and then revisiting this regularly, let's say weekly or monthly, is a good way to keep track and see if you need to course correct in some way. To improve the goal-directed activity itself, it's good to have an accountability partner. An example of this is having a gym buddy, or to go to a French class together with someone else. Or go public with your goal so that people know about your plans. These are all things that make it more likely that you will work consistently towards a goal. So these are just a few suggestions of useful techniques, but maybe the most important part is self-awareness. To look at it from your unique perspective. What is your environment, your background, your current ability and desires? When are you at your best? And when are you at your worst? How can you set yourself up for more success? If you're not a morning person, then maybe you should do a certain activity in the evening instead. If you know you struggle with regulating any part of yourself when you're tired, then maybe improving sleep should be the first step, or adjusting your schedule to do the most important tasks when you're likely to have the most energy. Also, try to find a goal with an intrinsic motivation, meaning it's something you like or love to do and feel drawn to. Let's say you want to exercise, but don't like running or going to the gym. But you love dancing or swimming, well then do that. You're much more likely to stick with something that you enjoy doing. Maybe you want to eat more greens, but you don't really like salads or just plain fruit. But you really like drinking smoothies, well then you can get your veggies there instead. Another great way to work with your motivation for goals is to make them bigger than yourself. When we involve the well-being of others in our intentions, we tend to become more motivated. If you want to, let's say, meditate or do some stress-releasing activity, you can look to how it will benefit loved ones around you in addition to your own benefit. Or you can add some form of volunteering as part of your goals. When we include others and we move the motivation outside of ourselves and our own direct benefit, it has a positive effect both on our motivation and our psychological well-being. I hope you enjoyed this episode with Michael Inslicht as much as I did and got some interesting ideas to reflect on. I'm grateful that you took the time to tune into this podcast, and if you like the material, please subscribe to the show, and I'll see you next time.